the players, the locker room, the coaches, they pass it on to the next generation. Even though, you know, some coaches have gotten fired, but still they remember, players have gotten cut or traded, and they remember, and their feelings are still with the Raiders. But there's so much that goes on off the field that helps helps establish that type of a feeling. And then, you know, as the game got bigger and bigger, that got bigger and bigger. And then players, sometimes they can hardly, well, what's so neat about the Raiders? And then they get here, and then they say, wow, this is a pretty good place. You know, it's nice in here. You know, the players are treating me nice. And, you know, as long as you do what you have to do, and this is what they got you for. You play hard, study hard, practice hard, you know, and then, you know, you can do your own thing whenever you have time. But one thing about the players, don't you do anything to screw up this team. Because they would take care of it.
Mm-hmm. What's the myth and what's the fact about Al Davis, both as a person and also as a football administrator?
Well, I think he's a brilliant man. I think he had such vision even way back then on what was around the corner, what he felt was going to happen. And I mean, he knew years before it happened that you know, we were going to have to do this in order to win. We were going to have to do this in order to win. And He dedicated himself to the game of football. Now, you know, Pete, you might question some of the things that he's done, but I don't think that he's ever done anything to hurt the game. He's done things to get an advantage, or where he felt some things were done unfairly. He's, you know, created some
animosity.
Yeah, animosity. But Al is very loyal to those who have been loyal to him. You'll never hear. I have a little chapter in the book about him. And you'll never hear about it because it's not news. The news is when he sues somebody or something like that. But he and Pete Rozelle always went head-to-head, but both of them had one thing in common. They loved the game, and they did everything they could to promote and make the game better. Tex Schramm was the same way. You know, these guys were the ones that set the standards for professional football. But Al has always been that way. He's always been tenacious. You'd want him as your best friend. You wouldn't want him as your worst enemy. He's been a winner, and when you think he's down, he comes back. But he's also very loyal and very kind. There's a lot of things about him that people don't know about.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit later on. And I'm just wondering, as the game has changed, as society has changed, I'm just wondering whether it's been hard for Al Davis to adapt.
I don't think it has. I don't really think it has. You know, he's losing a lot of his friends. You know, Sid Gilman passed away, and a lot of the guys are his good friends are no longer around. But you know, he has tried to stay on top of things, and the things that he believes in that make a winner are still the same things that people are winning with. You know, size, speed has always been a big factor, and getting the best players and making sure that they play up to their abilities and making sure that they're directed properly. You know, it took him a while to find the good mix in coaches. He got John Gruden, and John Gruden was a great coach for the Raiders. And when he left to get something for himself. And it worked out good for both teams because Callahan took over and didn't miss a beat.
What will be his legacy at some point when he does leave the game or does pass away, you think?
Well, I think he'll be remembered as, you know, he's already in the Hall of Fame, and there will be a lot of stories, and probably most of them not true, but he'll be remembered as a unique football person that lived the game and left the game as his legacy. The Raiders will be his legacy because this is his pride and joy, the Raiders.
Yeah, and what I will find interesting is that the perception of him from the outside will be different from what it was from the inside of those that wore the uniform, because you alluded to it just a little, but you alluded to the fact that he was always there for his players, not only when they played for the Raiders, but also after they played for the Raiders as well.
Yeah, he was, and still is.
Yes.
To this day. And he doesn't remember. He doesn't forget. He doesn't forget. I mean, you could be sitting in your living room and all of a sudden the phone will ring and say, "How you doing? You know, what can I do for you if you have a problem?"
I do want to touch on the move from Oakland to Los Angeles, because there are teams that take on the personality of the community they happen to be in. And I don't know that maybe the Pittsburgh Steelers, a lot of people say the Steelers have that personality of that town as well. I certainly think that the Raiders had the personality of the East Bay, blue collar and everything. Talk to me about that personality when they were in Oakland. And then when they moved down to Los Angeles, Tom, what happened then?
Well, I was we moved to L.A. and started playing in Los Angeles in 82. And then I started in 79. So 79, I was just getting my feet wet. And there was already the rumbling about the unhappiness and the Coliseum not wanting to do certain things. And I thought that had all settled after the 79 season. And so I went off to the Pro Bowl just to go see the Pro Bowl and get away for a few days. And when I came back, it all hit the fan, and all of a sudden, you know, from good to bad. And then, but we won the Super Bowl in 80 in Oakland, and it was great. I mean, you know, it's good to, it was our second Super Bowl victory, my first one as a head coach, and things were going well, but still the uncertainty of whether we were going to be there or not. And then 81, obviously, the decision was made, so we were kind of like a lame duck team. We hadn't played in L.A., excuse me. We played our first game in San Francisco in 1982, and then our second game was in Atlanta, and then we went on an eight-week strike without a game. So we stayed in Oakland rather than move down to L.A., finished the season practicing in Oakland and flying down to L.A. for every home game and then flying to wherever we had to go for every away game. So, and then the following year, 83, we went to Santa Rosa again, and when we broke camp, we went down to L.A., and most of us lived in hotels, so I lived in a hotel for 14 months.
Tom Flores has joined us here on Sports Byline. Let's talk about that Super Bowl game. A lot of people, if I remember correctly, because you were a wild card team, thought it was going to be all Eagles, that this was a team that was going to beat you rather handily, and it was anything but that. How soon in that ball game did you think that, hey, this is going to be our day?
Well, you know, first of all, we had played them early in the year, and they had beaten us in a very close game. I think it was like 10-7 or something like that. And they had a fine team. They had a good defense and a solid running game. But we felt that you know, I didn't know if we could move the ball consistently on them because we had not been able to do that. I didn't know if we could get the big play because that was our thing. We had to get the big play. And early in the game when our defense was playing so well, and then when Jim Plunkett broke the pocket and drifted off to his left and hit Kenny King down the sideline, he went, you know, 80 yards for the touchdown. Then I said, you know, that kind of got everything going, and it really shifted the momentum to our side. And then when we blocked a field goal attempt right before the half and sent him in the locker room, well, that killed him. That just killed him. I just felt there's no way they're going to beat us.
Let's talk about the second Super Bowl victory. That season, how did it compare to the one in which you won the first Super Bowl?
Well, in 83, we had a great football team. In 80, we had a great team, but we had some players that had to play. You know, they had to reach down, and they were at the end of their careers, and they had to reach down. Like I said, Bobby Chandler, Burgess Owens, and Cedric Hardman, and we had just gotten Kenny King, and then we resurrected Jim Plunkett. So all those things had to come together, which they did. Along with the great players that we had, and Jim was just marvelous that year. And then in '83, we had a great team. We were great all year. We never stumbled. We lost to Seattle twice, and it seemed like every time we played Seattle, we were fumbling or something. We had seven turnovers in one game, and we actually sat Jim Plunkett down because he was so beat up and started Mark Wilson. Then he broke his shoulder, and Jim came in, rested, and took us the rest of the way. So we had a great team, and it was a lot different that year because, and once again, we had played Washington in the regular season in a wild and crazy game in D.C., and they had beaten us by 1 or 2 points. A high-scoring game, and they had just broken the record, so they were heavily favored. I thought we could move the ball on them. I didn't know if we could stop them.
Mm-hmm. Charlie Sumner called the key play of the game.
Well, he called a key play of the game right before the half, and you know, when, as Yogi Berra would say, déjà vu all over again. we had played them in Washington, and in Washington, right before the half, they had thrown a screen pass to Joe Washington, and it was a screen pass to the right, and he took it about 55 yards all the way down inside our 10-yard line. So this was right before the half, but we had him backed up. So Charlie sent Jack Squirek in the game and said, you lock on Joe Washington, and everybody else is going to play zone. sure as shooting, Theismann goes back and he pumps one away, and without looking, he just throws it. And Squirek intercepted the ball. Matt Millen came out of the game. He was furious. You know how Matt is. Because he was taken out of the game. And he's standing there and he's just fuming. All of a sudden, the interception, the touchdown. And then the next thing I know, he's got Charlie up in the air, hugging and kissing him. So I'm yelling and screaming. And so we were just, everything we did was, Derek Jensen blocked a kick, a punt. I mean, we recovered it for a touchdown. Jack Squirek intercepts the pass. There was one play, and this was one of the best plays I've ever seen in my life, by a great, great athlete, Ray Guy, and it was in this. We were on about our own 30-yard line, and he was punting. And the ball was sailed. It was about 10 feet high. And he went up with one hand, caught the ball, came down, and without missing a stride, punted the ball inside their 20-yard line. And had he not, I think the score was like 14-3 at the time, they would have had the ball inside our 20. And it might have been a lot different going in at halftime, and the momentum might have been different. But it looked like a routine play. That's how great an athlete he was.
Yeah, he was truly a great athlete. I think underrated. I don't think a lot of people have ever appreciated, because they think of punters as just being somebody that goes out there every now and then and kicks the ball.
If you asked players on our team who the best athletes on the team were, he would always been up there. He would been right with the rest of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Marcus Allen had the great run in that ball game.
Yes,
right?
He did. Mm-hmm. And we practiced that all the time, you know.
Excuse me?
We practiced that a lot. You know? Yeah, we did. We said, we're going to run to the left. It's going to be bottled up. You're going to reverse, and you're going to pick up Jim Plunkett as your blocker, and then you're going to sprint and run away from everybody.
Yeah. Jim Plunkett, lead blocker. There's something wrong with this picture. And that is a type of play that truly the great ones make. I mean, they have a sense. And I think that's a hallmark play in Marcus Allen's career. I mean, when you ask people about things you remember about Marcus Allen, I think it is probably that one particular play. What was this essence of his greatness?
Well, he was just a complete player. I mean, from day one when we drafted him and we got him. See, we coached him in the Gold Bowl. That was a one-time bowl game down in San Diego, our staff against Dick Vermeil's staff. And we had him, and he just played a few plays. But I knew John Robinson real well. He was my roommate one year with the Raiders. And so we got to know him pretty well. And when he was there, we were hoping that he would be there. And there was no question. That was, Ron Wolf and I looked at each other and said, this is the guy. Because Al was in court, but he was on the phone. So, he was involved in everything that was going on. And from day one, he could do it all. He could play, he could block, he could catch, he could throw the ball as well as most quarterbacks. And he set a lot of the guidelines for practices, because he practiced hard. I mean, really hard. And he had learned that at SC. Sometimes it was a pain because he'd run the ball 40 yards all the time. And we'd have to wait for him to come back so we could run another play. But that's the way he was. And during game time, it's hard to keep him out of the game, even though he was banged up.
It's interesting, because if you think about John Madden's personality, he was the same on the sideline as we see him today as a broadcaster. You were the antithesis of that. You were always calm. I mean, I could watch you on the sideline and not see too much emotion from you, very under control. And I'm just wondering how that worked within the Raider organization, going from somebody demonstrative to somebody really under control, like you said.
Well, I think, you have to establish your own personality. I remember when Al was getting ready to hire me, I said, I'm not like John. He said, I know what you're like. I've known you. He knew what I was like. I played for him. And he said, I'm not the yeller and the screamer, and I can't be what I'm not. And I always felt my greatest strengths were knowing the game, knowing how to put the game together, knowing how to get a game plan together and implementing the game plan, making the right decisions at the right time. And I think when you do that, you have enough guys that can yell and scream. But if the team is prepared, that's the greatest motivator they can have. Is we feel good. We're ready. We're ready to play. I had my moments of emotion, but you never saw them or heard them because I would always cup my mouth with my hand if I was going to say something that you might lip read, and everybody thought I was really cool.
Yeah. What were the guys like on John? Because I've heard the war stories. He's 32 years old when he becomes the Raiders coach, and they would play practical jokes on him.
Oh, yeah.
Ted Hendricks and all those guys.
Well, Ted was playing jokes on everybody. You know, Ted would get bored, and that's when he got dangerous. He got bored in training camp, and you know, one time and everybody was in on the joke, and we'd go to practice, and here comes Ted on a horse. He's got this long pole. He's with his helmet on, and he was like Sir Lancelot coming down, and everybody roared, and John broke out. He didn't know what to say, because he came on and said, "What's going on?" He said, "There's something going on." You knew, because everybody was kind of standing around. Mm-hmm. I had a couple. They were always doing something like that to break the monotony of training camp.
Tom Flores, a man who personifies Al Davis's mantra of just win, baby. Finally, let's talk some baseball. Most who know the game will tell you that Darrell Evans was probably the most underrated player to put on a major league uniform. He played for Atlanta, San Francisco, and Detroit over a successful 21-year career. Primarily a third baseman, Evans was the first player to hit 40 home runs in both leagues, and he was the first 40-year-old to hit 40 homers in a season. And he hit more than 400 home runs during his career. Now that's success. His career was also marked with a World Series title with the Detroit Tigers. I find it impressive when any athlete can play their sport for double-digit years, so I asked Evans if it impresses him that he was able to play for more than 20 years.
Yeah, I don't even know if that was really me, Ron. You know, it was so long that you kind of go through generations. We've been talking about that, you know, with alumni associates. You go back and see guys that you played with and played against, and then guys that have been out of the game 10 or 12 years now, and you played against them too. So I played in a great era and a bunch of fun and three great ball clubs and three great sports cities and had so much fun. I can't tell you. I think I was the luckiest guy in the world.
What does it take to be able to play that long at this level?
Well, I think, you know, you got to be lucky in a lot of ways. I mean, health-wise, obviously, talent-wise. And I think a lot of it, too, was that I kept getting incentives. You know, I came up as a young player with the Braves and all those great teams with four Hall of Famers on the team and a veteran team that taught me a lot. And I had Eddie Matthews there who really helped make me a player. Learned how to play the game, and then could kind of take that when I got over the Giants to a team that was a little younger and kind of bring a little bit more of that. And then we got really good. They made some great trades with Vida and those kind of things, and we got in a chance to be in the playoffs and all that kind of, you know, you just kind of forget about it. And then when I went to the Tigers as a 37-year-old old guy that the Giants basically, didn't want to, not they didn't want me, but it was just that they didn't want to keep me around for two or three years. Went to a perfect situation where I got to be part of a young ball club that was hungry. I didn't really have to be the main guy all the time, or one of them. So you just kind of keep playing. And people keep asking you, how can you do this? And you go, well, you know, I never thought that I would ever have to wake up. You know, if I could still play Thursday night, have a good game Thursday night, I didn't think waking up Friday morning I was going to be through. So it became an incentive, actually, to kind of not prove to people, but say, hey, you know what? I got a chance to keep playing this game as long as I want to, as long as I'm successful, because I've been lucky enough to get in good situations here and contribute. And you learn that different times you contribute different things. As a young player, you just kind of follow along. And then when you're an older player, you can do so much more than just what you do on the field. And that becomes your incentive for playing.
How important is it to be in the right place at the right time as an athlete? You're laughing, so I think I know the answer.
I think it's pretty important, yeah. Well, like I say, you know, just what I was talking about, just so many times. The first time I got traded, the time I got traded to the Giants was such a traumatic thing because I wasn't playing very good. The first time I really hadn't played baseball good for a long, long time. It was a scary feeling. You kind of feel like nobody wants you. And then getting over here, all of a sudden I got rejuvenated because now it was like I was a part of a team that didn't know how bad I was playing at the time, and they wanted me over here and got part of this with the rivalry and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that was a big boost. I could have, you know, if I wouldn't have been playing on a good ball club in Atlanta and then gotten to a good ball club with the Giants, basically, you know, your career could be over if you don't really perform. But I had a chance to kind of come back from that kind of stuff. So those kind of things happen. And then, again, like I say, you know, how many times you could just go out there and sprain your ankle, step in a hole. You know, things happen off the field. You get hurt. And I was never on the disabled list. So I the only times I got hurt were in the off season, I guess. So that part of it you can't control either. So I don't know. Like I said, I was just I was blessed in a lot of ways, and I was hungry to keep playing. So I learned how to play hurt, and I played, you know, didn't ever want to give anybody an excuse to not play me.
Those first 9 years with the Atlanta Braves, I've always said that mentoring was such an important part in professional sports. Somebody takes the young player underneath their wing. You mentioned about the veteran players that were in Atlanta. We don't see that today because players are rushed through the minor leagues. They're brought up. If they don't make it there, they're moved on to another organization. Talk to me about those veteran players and how they helped you and what it was like being on a veteran Atlanta team.
Well, I think that's you made a perfect point because the veteran players now haven't been, and it's been probably a couple generations now, where they haven't really spent a lot of time in the minor leagues. Not that they didn't earn their spot, but to really appreciate how you got there and why you were there and what your responsibility is after you get there. I mean, you're playing at the top level. There's no other level to go. When you're in the minor leagues, you're playing basically for yourself. Sure, you want to win, and you're trying to win ball games and everything, but you get moved up. And as you get to the big leagues, all of a sudden there's no other league to play in. And you realize that those guys that have been there for a while, you're playing with a bunch of men that want to kick your butt. And they're not going to let you, you know, they're not going to let you come in there without some respect and earning that. And I think that that was a big thing playing longer and longer that you realize that, I mean, Hank Aaron and Phil Niekro and Orlando Cepeda and Rico Carty, just sitting there listening to how they played the game and how they expected everyone else to play the game because they were already at the top level. It wasn't that they were satisfied playing themselves, but they weren't satisfied unless everybody played to that level. So I think if you don't understand that, you don't really get the most out of that your career.
You know, I've said this, and I know you're going to agree with me on this, Darryl, and that is with good ball clubs, good organizations, championship ball clubs, no matter what the sport, the discipline and the direction of that team comes out of the clubhouse, comes out of the locker room. It doesn't come from the manager or the general manager. And you mentioned about those veteran players saying, hey, this is the way we play Atlanta baseball. This is the way we play Dodger baseball. And I really think that is one of the things that's missing in the game today.
Well, you look at the Braves. Look at the Braves. They made such a long run. Why is that? I mean, they've made a lot of turnovers. They've had, but, you know, their veteran key veteran players are pretty much the same guys. They were taught how to play. This is the way it's going to be here. No matter whether you got great credentials or you're a young superstar, so what? That doesn't really matter up here in the big leagues. It matters in how you get along. You know, I look back and I don't know, my 5 or 6 years where I've been in a pennant race and lost by 1 or 2 games. And you look back and you go, you know what? It wasn't because I didn't get another hit or make another play or do anything. It was because of the way the team played. And in the long run, when you do win, you realize that that's what it's all about. It's not one guy having great years, and it's not one guy doing a special thing. It's everybody being on the same page all the time. And you can lose the pennant in April and in May just as easily as you do at the end, because then when you got to win ball games, you should have won. You look back and you go, man, I'm going to spend all 4 or 5 months in the winter agonizing over this thing. And after a while, you realize that, you know, when you walk into that clubhouse like I did, kind of in 84 with Detroit. They were hungry. I wasn't there before, and I wasn't even American League. I didn't really know those guys. I knew Sparky called me and said they were great players, and obviously they were, but they were hungry. They were not going to lose again, and they learned how to do that. And, you know, you just wish that everybody gets a taste of that, because once you get a taste of it, it never happens again. And then you've got so many guys that are on that page that when someone new comes in, they have to play that way. And until you do that, you know, all the teams that win, I mean, we look back, sure, there's free agency, but the majority of the teams that win have come from within, and they've played together for a long time, and they realize it's new, and it's not about just you, what you're doing. It's about what everybody around you is doing.
Do you think the fact that players are rushed through the minor leagues because they're paid so much going in to the minor leagues before they even prove themselves, that the foundation for these players is not there when they reach the major leagues?
Well, sure. I think everything experience helps in any way. And some of them, you know, sometimes now I'm a manager, and I've been a manager for a long time and a coach. And one of the things that you got to find out about players is that most of them have been successful and have not lost, or they have not had a bad year or been disappointed for even a couple of weeks. And that's when you find out really how they know how to play the game and whether you can count on them. And some of them it takes longer to and they never get it. So they're not around, and you don't want those kind of people around, because you have to lose almost 50% of the time in baseball. So you have to come back from that and be better when you come back. And it's a great way of learning not only about baseball but life. So, yeah, I think it was a good thing to stay in the minor leagues longer. I know none of us want to do that, and we hear all these great stories about guys that stayed 8 or 10 years. with what they get paid, they don't get, that's hard to do and have families and everything. But the rewards are there. You appreciate those guys even longer because when they come up, they have no problem. They know how to play.
Do you think the big money the players are getting going into the minor leagues, the multi-millions of dollars, changes motivation in a sense?
Well, it can, and I think it's an individual thing. I'm sure, there's a lot of guys that love playing. And where I'm at in the independent league, they've all either coming out of college, didn't get drafted or didn't sign with somebody, or they've played and done pretty well and have been hurt and are coming back, or they've been to the top. We have four guys who have been major league or triple-A guys, but they're all hungry to play. So the motivation isn't necessarily the money. Some guys use that as a crutch because now when they and again, probably because they've been super successful and have never lost and have never don't realize that now you're playing against the best players in the world. You're not always going to get a hit. You're not always going to be successful. And until that happens, until you learn how to do that, yeah, it could be the reason why more guys don't stick around on it.
Darrell Evans has joined us on Sports Byline. We're talking a little baseball with the former third baseman who started his career at Atlanta and then moved over to the San Francisco Giants. You mentioned about how traumatic it was. What was it that made it so traumatic for you? Was it going from East Coast to West Coast, going or just being traded or moved for the first time?
Well, you know what? You kind of want to feel loved all the time. And when nobody, when you're not hitting, not playing very good, you don't have many friends, Ron. Nobody wants to talk to you. No one knows how. I mean, everybody feels for you. But when you're not playing very good and not doing especially, I was counted on to do something big time there. With Hank Aaron and then Eddie Matthews, of course, and then Dusty Baker and I kind of came in there. We were kind of thought of as the new Aaron and Matthews. And I know that's not a fair thing to put on any kid, but, people expect certain things. When you're not doing them, they just don't know what to say to you. And, like I said, nobody sit next to me in the dugout very much. They didn't want the stuff to rub off. And I really, it was the first time I really gone through a time where, not that I wasn't playing very good, but I was just playing terrible. I just couldn't do anything right. And you start feeling sorry for yourself and all that kind of stuff. And I had one great moment during that time. A guy that had scouted me in high school and college ended up being at the ball game and came down before the game. And, I'm moping around, all that kind of stuff. And he goes, "Hey, what's wrong with you?" And I go, "Well, I'm just not here." He goes, "No, I don't mean that." He goes, "You're not playing the game like you used to play the game." That really woke me up. That was, and kind of put things in perspective, that you don't have any control over what you hit, how many home runs you do, and whether you make errors and all that kind of stuff. You have control of how you go about it. And that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. That was a blessing in disguise. So it was great that it was a big disappointment that they didn't want me. It's not that they didn't want me with the Braves. They had to make a trade. They had to make Jimmy Wynn and myself. Jimmy Wynn was a free agent at the time, and we both were just got off to terrible starts. They had to make some, and they were expected to win. Got Willie Montanez, who was a good trade for them. And I got to come home, closer to the West Coast. That was a neat thing, and I think that made him more comfortable. If I had gone to some other cities, I don't want to mention here, but, that might have been a little different. But coming to a great city, and, I grew up watching that giant Dodger rivalry. And even though my family was kind of Dodger, they're Dodger fans, although they claimed they weren't when I was playing for the Giants. I found out later now that that's not true. But, that was exciting in itself to be part of that and see what that was going to be like. And, of course, that took off when I got, in the late 70s, it became a big deal again.
They talk about the Yankee-Boston Red Sox rivalry, and that's one rivalry. But the one on the West Coast here, how does it differentiate between a rivalry still on the East Coast? Because I do think that they're discernibly different.
Well, if you live on the East Coast, do you think that's a bigger deal than it is out here? That's basically it. But, that's become kind of a rivalry lately. As you look back with the Giants and the Dodgers, the more you hear from people, and now that it's gotten farther and farther in the past, people still, I hear this all the time, you know, I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. I was a New York Giant fan. Killed me. It broke my heart that they moved out. Anytime we go to New York or any place around there, people still talk about that. So it's sure the Boston, the Red Sox and Yankee kind of has been become a big thing because they're both have won some pennants now and been in the press and all that kind of stuff a little more. But, you know, the Dodger-Giant rivalry that moved from New York out to here, unless you've kind of been part of that. And, you know, we're on the left coast here, so we don't kind of, you know, we don't shape up to a lot of other places back there. We don't get as much publicity for it. And maybe because somebody's got to win this thing. If one of the teams wins, and, you know, it'll be back in the news again, and it'll be just as important. But, you know, whatever team you're a fan of, it doesn't matter. You're a fan of that team, and that rivalry is the most important thing.
What is the difference between the fans as they view the rivalry and the way the players view it?
Well, I think the players, it takes longer for the players because the players haven't been there. The fans have been there. They've lived it. I mean, you know, you know when people will their season tickets and you see the same people going back here from Candlestick to the new ballpark now, same people. I've gone out there, and there's a lot of same people out there, the vendors and all kinds of stuff. So that tradition's carried on. The players, because you move around unless you've been part of that. And I grew up in L.A. and hated the Dodgers when that was happening. So, you know, I became a big fan of that. And that was such a boost to us all because I look back now and the way that Detroit's going crazy because, of, you know, the same way it was in 84, watching – every night, people can't wait to when the Dodgers and Giants were playing. And it was just in the community. So it was, if you really looked around and if you were part of the ball club for a little while, it made you get caught up in that whole thing. And you could hardly wait. You know, we used to love having, you know, Tommy walk out from, you know, from the bullpen to the dugout. There was always something going to happen. And, you know, I mean, fights and the intensity. I mean, we literally hated each other. I mean, not personally. You know, we're not off the field, but we're on the field.
Competitively.
I mean, well, you know, I think everybody, growing up, even in the minor leagues, I didn't like the Dodgers because they had, their uniforms were clean and tailored and everything else. We had all the hand-me-downs wherever I played. So it was just something that you kind of just had fun with, obviously. But it really made you play harder, and it really did involve the whole community.
I have to ask you a question, because when I came here and you were on the team, Candlestick Park is where the Giants played. Now, you played in the launching pad that they called Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. The wind is what they always talked about, the cold, that the players didn't like it. What was the fact about that? How did the players feel about Candlestick?
Well, I think after a while, when you played it for a while, the same thing, you got to overcome it. You can't make it a big deal to you every single day. You're playing 81 games in the park that, you know, obviously we know the problems with it in some ways. And it seemed like you don't want to make it an excuse for losing. And I think that's what happens when the guys that first came in. You know, that was kind of, well, it's too cold. It's windy. I've been here before. I know there's something. But I think one of the big things that kind of gets overlooked is that it had sometimes something to do with who won the ball game. And I don't know if that ever evens out, you know, with the wind or whatever happened or, you know, what the weather and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it wasn't fun to go out there and hit and that stuff all the time, but you had to learn and maybe you had to get better at it, and we did. But I think back, you know, I think, you know what, if we would have played in another ballpark, maybe we would have won one time, another one or two ball games that the wind blew a ball in or whatever. So I don't know if it evened up or not, but I just don't think it did. So I think that's more the way the players think, because you got to go out and go to work. I mean, you eventually get used to it. Not used to it, but you eventually just got to put up with it. And there was a lot of funny things that happened out there with, the mustard wrappers. And, you know, I mean, I've seen people get hit with foul balls and just been laughing. You know, hats go to center field all the time. You know, when you're standing out there at third base and the ball's just about getting into the hitting area and you got somebody up there, Mike Schmidt or somebody, and all of a sudden there's a little whirlwind in your face and you can't see. Just all kinds of good stuff like that. So it was a fun place to play. It was a tough place to play because of that, but it was a beautiful place. It was in the major leagues, and I loved it.
You had 414 career home runs. And you were somebody that hit for power, but you also seemed to be very smart at the plate. I'd watch you sometimes, and you'd take what was given you. In other words, you didn't try to pull everything. If it was on the outside part of the plate, you'd go the other way. Where did that discipline come from?
You must not have been watching me, Ron. That wasn't. But, well, you know what? I learned that, I mean, how can you not learn when, like I said, with Cepeda and Aaron right. and Cardi and all those, and listening to all these guys talk about hitting and what was going on. Being selective, Eddie Matthews, again, being, you know, one of the top walk leaders of all time, too. You can't swing at pitches you can't hit, and you've got to take advantage of trying to get ahead in the count. And I think after a while that the umpires realized that I had a pretty good idea of the strike zone, and there was close pitches that I sometimes got that maybe some other people weren't. And I learned to not really be scared of getting behind in an account, that – you know, the pitchers were going to hopefully make a mistake, and then I can't. If you miss that pitch, that's the difference between when you're hot and when you're not. You're not missing the pitches you should be hitting, but trying to get to those counts. And fortunately, being hit in front in the middle of a lineup, getting on base one way or the other was just as important to get Aaron and McCovey and Jack Clark to play. So I figured that out real early on.
Were there ballparks that you liked hitting in?
Oh, sure. You know, there's places that you love going to. It just seems like sometimes...
when the wind was blowing out Chicago, Wrigley?
Well, it never blew out there when we played. That's Bobby Mercer. I had one of the best days. I would have hit four home runs one day there, and I didn't get a hit. But, you know, that's, you know, maybe that's a good thing. You know, when you do that one time, they start expecting that stuff. So, You just some places you see the ball better. For some reason, sometimes it would just be heck. Every time I went to a ballpark, I was feeling good in Philly. I always loved hitting Philadelphia. I mean, I was short with the turf. You know, you just felt confident up there. So, you know, those kind of things didn't happen as much as they should have. I wish that would have happened everywhere.
1984, you move over to the American League and the Detroit Tigers. And I'm wondering, and I always wanted to ask somebody from that team, whether you had any indication at all at spring training, because usually when a team breaks camp and goes north, they kind of have an inkling about maybe what the team is going to be like, the type of season. You guys came right out of the gate, smoked everybody, and went right on to win the World Series. What did you guys see at spring training, and why did this team come together so quickly?
Well, you know, I was new. I was a free agent. I was in American or National League, and I had never even played against them in spring training. So... kind of being a baseball guy, you know, I mean, you're watching the other leagues and you're seeing what kind of players these guys have, and you're seeing them, and they almost won it in 83. I mean, you know, finished two or three games out of Baltimore, behind Baltimore. And then until I was a free agent and signed with them in December, up until maybe 6 weeks or 2 months before that, I didn't know that much about them. And then as becoming a free agent and them having some interest in me, I definitely started looking at them, talked to Sparky, called Sparky Anderson, a manager, told me how great of players these were and how these guys were hungry and everything. And then you go, yeah, okay, that's, you know, I was called crazy for not signing with, the Dodgers. I had a chance to sign with them because Steve Garvey went to the Padres that year, could have played first base for the Dodgers, my hometown team and all that kind of stuff. Been tough to get a lot of tickets down there, though, right? Or the Yankees, who were hot and heavy after me, but their situation was I probably would have been a DH, and I had never really done that before, and I really didn't want to. I think that would have stopped my career in a lot of ways, or you think about it. You know, people start thinking, they moved me from third to first, you know, where's the next place you're going? So, but when I got there, it was so different. These guys were hungry, and they're a bunch of young, great players, really kind of didn't know how good they were. They had played really good the year before and had lost to a great ball club, obviously, with Baltimore. And when we got to spring training, and they were kind of rewarded because I was a first-time free agent that had ever been signed there. We made a trade at the end of the for Willie Hernandez, and Dave Bergman kind of solidified some stuff. And they were rewarded for having that hunger. And, you know, we didn't have a particularly great spring as far as wins and losses, but boy, when you walk in a clubhouse and you see the determination on these guys, and these guys were such, I mean, I think people, if we would have won again in 87, I mean, we were playing in the best division in baseball by far, in American League East. There's probably, I mean, six teams, different teams won in a row there. And if we had won 87, I think people would realize not only just our hot start and our great year there, but how good that team really was. And we basically had an all-star team at every position, or all-star at every position. I mean, Howard Johnson was at third, got traded to the Mets, became a 40-40 guy. Our entire outfielder was great, and the pitching staff was terrific. And we had the best catcher and the best guys up the middle. We had the best up the middle in baseball, which were Whitaker and Trammell and Parrish behind the plate, and Chet Lemon in center field. So I was just a part of that. And I could, you know, they thought I'd won a bunch of pennants, I think. Maybe they weren't old enough to know who I was. But, you know, they were like, oh, what's it like to be in there? I go, okay, hey, just keep doing what you're doing, because that's what the whole thing was about. They were all about winning the thing, and they had already been successful as players and had learned that that wasn't good enough for them. They wanted to win it. And, man, when you go 35-5, I don't know how to explain that either. I mean, that just happens in any sport. Obviously, it seemed like Whitaker hit a double or a single, and Trammell hit a double or a single, and we'd be in front in the first thing every game. And, you know, we played flawless defense. That was one thing I think gets overlooked. We had a tremendous defensive ball club. A bunch of power and great pitching. I mean, it's tough to beat. But, you know, you get confidence all of a sudden. I mean, fourth game of the year, Jack Morris throws a no-hitter on national TV for a team that had played pretty good, and that was a great reward. And then all of a sudden we're 5-0, we go home, and, you know, the best – I mean, to go home and play my first game in Detroit, we played five games on the road. I hit home run opening day on the road, which was a great thrill, obviously. But to go home – to go to the place where you're a free agent – a lot expected of you. The teams expect. I go and through first time up, Whitaker's on, Trammell's on. I'm hitting third. Dave Stewart was pitching for Texas before the A's, and I had a 3-run homer my first swing in Tiger Stadium. Now, now all of a sudden I'm part of this team and I'm part of that whole thing, and now they're going, oh yeah, okay, well that's good. We made a great trade too. So it just exploded like it is right now. It's nothing like being in that. It just rejuvenates everybody. The city. The area, people love going to work. They can't wait to wake up in the morning, watch the score, or stay up and watch the game. So, and when you kind of feel that, and those guys didn't really know much about that, and you realize that after you played for a long time how important that really is to people, they started getting that feeling, and we couldn't lose. No matter what we did. Every time we needed a bloop, of course, it fell in, and when there was a line drive, we were in trouble, it was a line drive right at somebody. Just kept riding that streak, and we even got, when we were 35-5, we ended up in Anaheim, just won 17 in a row on the road. We literally got a standing ovation from the Angel fans, which doesn't happen very often on the road, obviously, but, I mean, it was just a magical thing. I mean, this can't really be happening to you.
Yeah, it was a great year. Let me switch gears with a couple minutes that we have left, because being a pilot, I've been in the cockpit. And I've seen things I can't explain. And, of course, you know, you mentioned it's in your bio about you and your wife living in Pleasanton and seeing a UFO. Now, I knew of the story, but tell everybody what it was, what the circumstances were, because I think it's a fascinating story.
Well, it was in 81, and I was having a terrible time playing for the Giants. I wasn't doing very well, and individually anyway, and we were doing okay, but I was just disappointed in myself and how things were going, and I was just having trouble getting going, and I don't know, I kind of look at it as something that I needed. It was just a glimmer of hope or something, I don't know. I went home living in Pleasanton, sitting out there watching the small planes flying around at nighttime, and it's beautiful, you know, clear and seeing all the kind of things, and then you see this big white light as I got home, because my wife had seen that, and she yelled at me and hurry up and come see it. We had two dogs, German Shepherd and a Cocker Spaniel, where their tails were wagging. They saw it, watched it come up close my neighbor's yard, so, you know, 50 yards away. It wasn't like it was a far enough away that you could say, hey, well, you know, I didn't see it. We both saw it. Went in there to kind of figure out, you know what, let's get a camera. I couldn't understand, though. There was all these planes would keep flying around, and none of them came over and followed it. You would think that something happened. So whether it was us that we were supposed to see us. But anyway, it stayed there for a little while. I was just going to go get the camera, and it kind of it said, the wings tilted, said, no, I'm not going to let you take a picture. Went over to the back of the hill behind us, and then became that same white light far away, and went left like, the Star Trek, white light's gone.
Darrell Evans may not be fully appreciated, but he had a long, successful career and a championship ring to prove to himself he was pretty darn good. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.